Computer crashes, virus attacks, theft. If one hasn't happened to your computer yet, it's just a matter of time. So be prepared. Get Carbonite Online Backup before you have your inevitable disaster. With Carbonite, your pictures and your other files are backed up automatically, and it's easy to get them back. Carbonite customers have had over 7 billion files safely restored. Think about that. Over 7 billion files restored that might otherwise have been lost forever. Plus, with Carbonite, you can access your backed up files from any computer or on your smartphone or iPad with a free app. Unlimited backup is only $59 a year. That's less than $5 a month. And here's a special offer. Try Carbonite free for 15 days. You don't need to give your credit card number. Plus, get 2 free months if you decide to buy. Just click on the Carbonite banner or visit Carbonite.com and use offer code FREETRIAL. That's Carbonite.com, offer code FREETRIAL. Or simply click on the Carbonite banner on your screen.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. Well, today marks the fifth segment in our second annual Franchise Legal Series, and what a series it's been. And if you recall, last year, the series was 4 segments, so I thought 7 this year might be a stretch, but it certainly hasn't turned out that way, as our listenership, both live and on demand, is considerably higher than last year, and I'm confident those numbers will continue to grow. You know, I believe the primary reason could be attributed to the riveting topics that our co-producer Joe Caruso has put together. It's been a very progressive path through the series, and seems like only yesterday that we began the series with Lane Fisher as my guest as we discussed financial performance representations. And then the following 2 segments were focused on digital matters within franchising as Jonathan Redgrave joined me to discuss social media and e-discovery legal issues. And then Lee Play followed with a great discussion about social media within franchising. So, you know, FPRs leading into social media, e-discovery, and basically all things online and digital seem to be a great deal of information. You know, all was focused on franchise best practices. But what tied it all together was last week's show with Warren Lee Lewis as my guest. And, of course, Warren, the author of the Franchise Seller's Handbook. So it was definitely most appropriate to tie everything together with his take on franchise sales best practices. And now today, Joe Caruso has again tied it all together with today's topic, franchise broker issues in a digital world. Now, Leslie Curran, a partner at Plaif Cook, was originally scheduled to be on today's show, but was a last-minute cancellation due to a severe cold and a lost voice. And not having a voice is kind of difficult to be on the radio with. So I know Leslie definitely wanted to be here today, as we believe she is definitely an expert on franchise broker issues, and as evident by her popular white paper on the subject, and, of course, by the response to her appearance last year in our first franchise legal series, where she spoke about the pros and cons of utilizing franchise brokers. Now, scheduled to join Leslie was another Plaif Cook member, their managing partner, John Tifford. So in Leslie's absence, we'll have to place the whole burden of today's segment on John. But based on his bio, I see John having no problem doing so. John Tifford has counseled clients about a wide range of product and service distribution issues, such as creating franchised and non-franchised programs, formulating and implementing strategies addressing the offer of distribution relationships to prospective franchisees and licensees, and thereafter, the ongoing relationships with them, defending against federal and state regulatory investigations and enforcement actions, and participating in formal alternative dispute resolution proceedings, such as mediation. He's also been engaged to serve an expert witness in various private lawsuits, and he has testified as a franchise expert before Congress and state legislators, participated as a panelist in several FTC public forums on consumer protection issues, served on committees of the IFA, including its legal and legislative committee and educational foundations, written and spoken extensively on issues relating to franchising, advertising, and other consumer protection matters, listed as the best in, within the best lawyers in America and who's who in America, and has been named the Legal Eagle by Franchise Times. And before entering practice in 1988, Mr. Tifford served with the FTC, where from 78 to 88 he was in charge of the FTC's franchise rule program, including the launch of the franchise rule and oversight of the FTC's enforcement and compliance advice activities. And before that, he served in a similar capacity with respect to the FTC's land sales program. Quite a resume indeed, and a great guest for today. John, welcome to Franchise Today.
Thank you, Paul. It's good to be here.
It definitely is good to be here because it seemed like we were being thrown all kinds of wrenches with Leslie getting sick and then you having to leave the office because of a bomb or security threat. And then we haven't had rain in South Texas for 91 days. And 10 minutes before the show, the skies opened up, lightning and thunder. All our power went out. Phone lines went down. So it is a blessing that we are actually on the air, and hopefully we won't have any difficulty today. John, give us a little bit of your background and some things you'd like to share with us as we lead into today's show.
Well, I think thank you for that very nice introduction. Most of the things that you reported about I actually did, which made good. I was at the FTC and was in charge of the FTC's franchise rule from the time it came out and helped write the rule and administered it for the first 10 years. I think the important thing to keep in mind about the franchise rule is that its goals are to create an informed investment decision by prospective franchisees. And the way that they do that is to provide a disclosure document that gives detailed information about the proposed franchise relationship and the terms of the franchise, as well as giving people sufficient time to be able to analyze the information that was given. One of the concerns that people had, and this sort of ties into franchise brokers and franchise sales in general, is that there are many aspects of the franchise sales process which by their nature give opportunities for consumer injury, and that injury would be caused either because of some unlawful acts by the franchisor or the franchisor's sales representatives in misstating or misrepresenting information, as well as even in areas where, everybody is acting in good faith. The franchisees just simply didn't realize what they were getting into, and had they had the time to think about and get advice about the nature of the business they're about to buy in terms of cost and time commitment and experience and background, they wouldn't buy. So the thought of disclosure and sales is really designed to give people an opportunity and make it harder during the sales process for people to deceive or misrepresent the franchise offer. Now, where the franchise brokers come in is there's sort of two ways a franchisor can sell. They can either have an in-house sales staff, or for a variety of reasons, they may choose either because they're small or they can't afford it or they don't want to use their resources in that way. They go outside to third parties and third-party brokers or consultants to do the sales effort on their behalf. And the concern that regulators have, both at the FTC and the state, is they want to be sure that the third parties, salespeople, are subject to the same rules as the in-house sales staff are, number one. And number two, they want to be sure that the franchisor is not using a third party as a manner of insulating itself from the various sales practices that the FTC wanted to prevent the franchisor from doing directly.
Sure, and of course, we know the advent of the FTC rules on franchising date back to 79. And when exactly do you recall that brokers actually popped on the scene? Was it shortly after that, or was it quite a while after that?
I think that brokers were always sort of around because the brokers are in the business of, you know, business brokers would be selling businesses and putting people together, and franchising is a different form of a distribution, a different way of businesses are run. So they were there before, and at the FTC rule and the states, the first state franchise disclosure law was California in 1971. They always had their eyes on the brokers and wanted to be sure that the brokers were subjected to the same rules and was subject to the same disclosure requirements as the franchisor and the franchisor sales personnel were.
Well, fast forwarding to the present, you know, under the 2008 FTC franchise rule, what changed with regard to the franchisor's use of franchise brokers and franchise sales outsource organizations?
Well, I think what's basically happened in the last several years is that the franchise brokers sort of changed a large number of them changed the way in which they did business. It used to be you would just sort of hire somebody or just retain one or two people who worked on your behalf. And if you did it that way, then it was no big deal to just add their bios in the UFOC item 2 and talk about their litigation history in item 3 and their bankruptcy history in item 4. That was not a real problem. But a number of years ago, franchise broker organizations or broker organizations started to get much, much bigger. And the method of business changed slightly so that, yeah, you would deal with a brokerage group that might have 100 brokers. And what they would say to the franchisor is, look, your exposure is everywhere. We have brokers all over the country. And your offer can be, and all of these people will sort of work, so we have a loose affiliation ourselves, but essentially we have a brokerage network of hundreds of brokers who are good for you and will work on your behalf. And once you have that, then the issue is how in the world do you disclose, put in bios of 100 or 200 people, especially since they can, you know, change every month. There could be new ones added, others that drop off. So from a disclosure standpoint, the manner in which to properly disclose a brokerage network of 200 became absolutely unmanageable. And I think that what the regulators decided is, since this seems to be a new way in which franchise brokerage activities work, they really needed to revisit the need for making disclosure. Now, the reason you wanted to have a broker disclosure in there to start with is if the franchise, a prospective franchisee is working closely with a broker, then the issue is we need to know who this broker was, and when the broker tells me something, should I have a sense of credibility that this broker knows what they're talking about and are not lying to me. And if you, since the sales broker had to include his litigation history in item 3, if in fact a broker had several actions pending or concluded or several disclosable actions, then the thought would be if I'm dealing with this broker and I look at the litigation history and see that he's been sued 4 or 5 times for alleged misrepresentation, maybe he's not someone I really want to rely on and use. So that concept, while it's certainly viable if you have a discrete number of brokers, just loses all capability as the size and network of brokers became so big. And so I think what the regulators concluded was that the franchisor still remains jointly and severally liable with the franchise broker for any unlawful conduct of the franchise broker. So there was enough of incentive for the franchisor to police the brokerage network that they use. And on the same token, by excluding them from the specific disclosures, they got rid of a sort of an unmanageable disclosure issue when you had a brokerage network of 100 or more.
You know, it's really an interesting time with so many different moving parts, even within the franchise sales process. So let's start at the fundamental side regarding franchise sellers. A while back, I wrote an article on the Franchise Essentials site. You know, the question posed is, are you a franchise seller? And I wrote, you know, on the surface, it doesn't appear to be too difficult to determine whether or not one is a franchise seller. Yet I hear time and time again the same rationalization and justification as to why a person feels they are not a franchise seller. I hear about trading off the candidate prior to the sale, only qualifying the candidate until the franchise salesperson actually talks turkey with the candidate. And just recently, I was told about presenting the candidate with three options, but the candidate has not sold anything. I mean, you know, my first question was, does anybody really believe that crap? And we'll leave that for a different part of this. So my question is to you is, who is actually a franchise seller, and why is it important that the franchisors, in order to be compliant, know who a franchise seller is?
Let me take the second part first. The franchisor needs to know because their disclosure obligations require that the identity of a franchise seller is made clear at the time, if not at the time of initial disclosure, then at least at the closing. So at the end of the day, after the franchisee buys a franchise, the franchisor has the obligation to be able to establish in writing that we have memorialized the names of every single person who is a franchise seller. So the quick answer to that part is the franchisor needs to know that and make sure that that's memorialized at the time of sale in order to be in compliance with both the FTC rule and the various state franchise disclosure laws. In terms of the first question of who is a franchise seller, the basic definition is anyone who sells, offers for sales, or arranges for the sale of a franchise, which is close to the definition that was used in the initial rule. And the issue always comes to the question of who, quote, arranges for the sale, close quote, of a franchise. And that's where the broker's issues have always come into play. And what what I always used as a guideline when I was at the FTC was, and now in private practice, is, first of all, are you paying somebody to help you? So if somebody is getting a commission or a salary or whatever based upon his or her ability to present candidates or either candidates or present actual sales to the franchisor, then they're a franchise broker. Right now they're a franchise seller. Anyone who's going to get paid, you ought to consider as being a franchise seller. And the second part is you need to take a look at the manner in which the individual participates in the sales process. Now, it's clear that if we have a sit-down and you and I work together for a month or two negotiating and explaining, there's certainly no issue with that. But there are many of the brokers who act on the periphery, who really don't get involved in the actual nitty-gritty negotiation or education, but merely identify people. And that's really where the issue comes. There are a number of franchisors who have taken the position that I don't want you to, Paul, I don't want you to sell my franchise. I just want you to bring me people who are qualified. Because every day, you know, I get 100 phone calls, I get 100 emails of people who want to know. But the fact is that 80 of them have $50 in the bank. And another 10 have never worked in a restaurant before. I'm a fast food restaurant. 10 of them have never worked in a restaurant. I don't need to train those kinds of people. And I don't want people who don't have a certain net worth. So, Paul, I'm going to give you a list of criteria. These are my qualifying criteria. And your job is to go out and find people who meet each of these criteria. And then when you're satisfied, then you come to me and say, here's an application from somebody. I've checked him out. He's got the money. He's got the background. He's got all the criteria you want. I've done my job. That's where the issue comes. So if you look at it from the point of a prospective franchisee, the seller has never really pitched the franchise per se. All they have done is made sure that the prospect has qualified to become a franchise. If that's all they do, then from a regulatory standpoint, you're saying, why do we need to sweep this guy in within the purview of the rule? Because he's not making any statements, he's not selling the franchise, he's not doing anything upon which a prospect would rely on at the time they purchase. That's being left for the franchisor. But by the same token, so from a regulatory standpoint, it's not nearly as important that disclosures appear with respect to that person because he doesn't really factor in that much in anyone's decision to buy or not buy a franchise. But because he gets money, then it's always safe to consider him as a franchise seller. And because he is participating in a certain level, and there's really no real issue involved in disclosure or regulatory other in terms of identifying him or not identifying him, other than making sure his name appears at the closing as being somebody who was involved in the sales process, then there's no reason that the franchisor should have a concern about listing him. And so my suggestion would be, when in doubt, put the person in. But the areas of real, the areas of real issues of where is the line, it's always a question is to what extent do they simply qualify people and to what extent do they go beyond the qualification and actually get involved in the sales process.
And I think from a practical matter, it is fairly safe to say that if they're doing all that work qualifying somebody and the end result is a significant commission to them for doing so, they're probably talking some about the concept. I feel confident in that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You mentioned about the acknowledgement receipt, which we know is item 23 in the 2008 franchise seller requirements. What exactly has to go there? There are some franchisors that are listening that are startup or even entertaining the thought about franchising. Can you give a little bit of a quick overview of what needs to be on that acknowledgement receipt?
Okay, sure. This is a perfect example of a regulators who came up with a theory and had no concept of the actual way in which the world works. The specific rule is that you need to list all your franchise sellers on your receipt. But of course, since you don't know until you get to the closing who's arranged for or participated in the sale, there's no way in the world that you can have a generic document that becomes effective, say, April 1st and is used for a year, and there's so many people who may or may not be involved in the sales process. There's no way in the world that you would be able to list everybody. So what we started to do was just simply our recommendation to people, and this is how we handle it. And the states have realized, and the FTC has backed off on that initial sort of very cursory statement and realized that, bring some reality into it by knowing you need to amend it. In item 23, you're supposed to put the name of the franchise seller. So we put the name of the key executive in the franchisor's system who is responsible for sales, like the senior vice president of sales. So we'd say the senior vice president of sales is X, and he works together with other employees, agents, and franchise consultants. And that's the way we do it. Then the FTC has backed off and said, well, now you can subsequently amend that. We use what's known as a compliance certification. That's what we recommend for our clients, almost all of whom will follow that. And that's a document that's signed at the closing of the sale, which it has the franchisee agree to a number or at least answer a number of questions concerning the sales process. And one of those questions is, who are the people that you have dealt with, you've spoken to during the time that you were considering this franchise? Name all of them, other than, third parties not affiliated with us. So name all of our employees, name any franchise consultant that you have spoken to during the time that you were considering our franchise. And then you're going to list a whole batch of people, and those we would deem to be franchise sellers. And then we just keep a copy of that certification together with a receipt so that at the end of the day, for every specific sale, you have a list of all the franchise sellers.
It seems that, and you use some of these terms, franchise broker, franchise consultant, it seems like there's a lot of brokers out there that go to great lengths to not call themselves broker. I mean, is it me or do a lot of people find that annoying? I mean, does calling yourself a franchise consultant change the fact that you're a franchise broker? And I ask you that question, John. If somebody calls themselves a franchise consultant, does it change the fact that they really are a franchise broker?
Absolutely not. The issue is, do they sell, offer to sell, or arrange for the sale of a franchise? I remember when I was at the FTC. This is the same thing in the rule about what is a franchise. And the fact that you happen to call it a license or a consulting agreement is irrelevant. The issue is, does the relationship meet the definitional elements of a franchise? You can call it anything you want. And I have to tell you, it's a little bit of an internal humor among franchise attorneys. You get clients that come to us and say, we don't want to be a franchise, we want to be a license. And you say,
oh great,
now just tell me. And then you go through the definitional elements. And they're a franchise, so they can call themselves anything they want. And some people really want to be known as, they use the word license. That's terrific. As long as they comply with the franchise law, they can call themselves anything they want. And it's the same thing with the sales brokers. If they sell, offer for sale, or arrange for the sale of a franchise, they're a what's now known as a franchise seller, what used to be known as a franchise broker.
So looking at it from a broker's responsibility, I don't know if it's an ethical responsibility or a moral responsibility or a legal responsibility, maybe it's really all three. Do brokers have a duty to tell their prospects that their client is the franchisor in order to, you know, avoid confusion of who the broker actually represents?
I don't know if they have a specific legal duty. They certainly don't have any specific legal duty under the FTC rule, nor under any of the state franchise statutes. There may be some common law in some states that might have some issues on these things, but basically not. But they really should, because there's sort of an implicit understanding that if I have retained you to work with me, then you owe me some kind of a duty of care. And that duty would be, you know, I need to try to be doing things for your best interests. And the fact is, if the franchise broker really is working for the franchisor's best interests rather than the prospects, and is just interested in finding people that the franchisor will approve and sell a franchise to, then the franchisee should be under no illusion about whether this broker is really working on their behalf. And one of the ways of doing that is making sure that the broker is for the broker to make sure that the prospect he's working with knows full well that, you know, I'm working for the franchisor here and many franchisors. And that's really my key interest. So look to others. So don't expect me to be acting on your best behalf.
Right. Well, when taking what we've discussed so far and moving it into today's world, the digital world, why does it seem like that there's this collective amnesia amongst franchisors and franchise brokers and if they want to call themselves franchise consultants regarding compliance and best practices? It's like, well, now that we're in this digital world and virtual world, a lot of them want to play fast and loose, and they seem to forget that it's still part of the real world. What's your opinion on that, John?
I think that, you know, people start to get a little casual, and they everything is so easy, and they just sort of forget that they have to take care of business. And one of the businesses, they need to be sure they're in compliance with the law. And one of the real issues with the digital world is that everything is much more is memorialized. So all these casual emails, all these casual statements, these Twitter, whatever you put on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, I mean, there's a written record. And it's going to be pulled up and used. So I think that I think people just sort of let their guard down because it just seems so easy, and they just don't worry about it so much. But they really should, because it's always lurking. And again, if anything, since more and more stuff is in print in an email someplace, it more and more can be disclosed and found and used against you if you've done something wrong.
I know a few weeks ago we had Jonathan Redgrave in the second segment of this legal series, and he was talking about social media and e-discovery legal issues. And he brought up an interesting fact that right now all tweets are being recorded and saved in the Library of Congress. And when you think about, I mean, just through the Osama bin Laden issue and his death, they were registering over 4,000 tweets a second. And you think of the millions of tweets every day. And in amongst all those tweets, we have seen earnings claims, whether they be links to articles whether that had an earnings claim in it, whether they be a link to an advertisement, whether they be something specific, as I've seen recently on Facebook, a fitness franchise has right in their Facebook ad that their typical sales are $1.9 million. I mean, all, you know, illicit FPRs and what have you. And I know Jonathan was talking about, you know, how, as you just said, a lot can be brought up in e-discovery and be asked to be produced. And of course, there's a tremendous burden there to do so. And there's, of course, a lot of franchisors that have yet to take that first step into social media, yet they're contracting with brokers that have taken the first step and then some into social media. And a lot of times the franchisors, you know, are throwing up their hands saying, well, I don't know anything about social media, and yet the brokers are out there promoting their concept and their brand on social media, and it really could cause havoc down the road. And I guess the question is then how much responsibility, whether or not they're in social media or not, how much responsibility does a franchisor have with regard to franchise brokers and franchise sales organizations in their marketing and communications within social media, and specifically on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, et cetera?
The answer, easy answer, is 100%. The bottom line is they are jointly and severally liable with everybody who's selling on their behalf for all the activities that the that any of these brokers or consultants perform on their behalf. And whether or not they authorized it or not is absolutely irrelevant. They are responsible. And when you think about it, it may seem harsh at first, but the flip side of it is you don't want a franchisor, from a regulatory standpoint, you don't want a franchisor to insulate itself from unlawful conduct by simply saying, well, I retain Paul, and I don't know what Paul is doing, but by the way, I pay him all the time he succeeds. Go argue with him, not me. The regulatory answer is you have benefited from Paul's unlawful conduct, and you're responsible for it. And because you benefit and because you retained him and authorized him to act on your behalf, you're responsible for everything he does. So the very simple answer is anything they say, any broker says on Twitter or Facebook or anything, pretend it's being said by the president of your company, because from a legal standpoint, it's the same thing.
You know, and the one thing I'd like to remind a lot of our listeners today, because I do a lot of business with franchise clients and do a lot of work within social media, and here's a hypothetical situation where you still have a responsibility, is that you may have a broker that's tweeting and posting about your brand on Facebook and never bring a lead or a candidate to the party, never sell anything on your behalf, but there may be other people that are sitting on the sidelines reading these tweets, reading these posts, monitoring these discussions on LinkedIn that use that information put out there by the broker to contact you independently of the broker, but they're basing it on the information that the broker put out there. You're still responsible. Am I correct in stating that, John?
Yes, if in fact you've retained the broker and they're authorized to act on your behalf, you're responsible for them. Now, there are two, I could just use a little bit of background. There are two areas in which you can get bitten. One, private lawsuits by the franchisee who subsequently discovers that the information they acted upon based upon this Twitter thing turned out to be wrong, and they bought in reliance upon that information. And secondly, are regulators who said, gee, I see this ad or this earnings claim that you referenced before, and I don't see an earnings claim disclosure in your FDD. You couldn't have made these claims. And the things I always worry about, of course, are the franchisees who have really lost a lot of money. The regulators are also an issue, but not nearly as serious. And the way that we always recommend that you try to do the best you can to police this is at the time during the sales process, and again, you just make sure you understand what is motivating the franchisee and what what information is the franchisee acting on and thinking they want to buy your franchise? And secondly, at the closing, we very much recommend that our clients use something known, we call it a compliance certification, but call it anything you want. But at the closing, you ask them a series of questions designed to see whether or not the sales process was lawful, number one. And number two, whether the franchisee is maybe acting under some misunderstanding of what the nature of this business is going to be. And so you ask them a series of questions, and some of them would be, did anyone make any earnings claims to you? Did somebody tell you how much money you'd make or what your sales would be or something along those lines? If you make an earnings claim, then, of course, you'd condition it by saying, other than what we have told you in item 19 of our FDD, has anyone made any statement to you about? And then you put the and have them affirmatively answer yes or no. And if it's yes, please tell me what it is. And we also say, who are the people, and I think I mentioned this earlier, tell me the people who you spoke with in connection with your, you know, investigation of this franchise. So we have a list of the salespeople. Now, the benefit of this, the compliance certification, is that, first of all, if they answer it saying, yeah, I think I'm going to make a $1.9 million because it was a tweeter that Paul put out last week that said that's what all these people do. Well, first of all, it's better that you know it now before the sales continue than find out 2 years from now.
Sure,
but secondly,
absolutely.
If they know, then 2 years from now, if in fact they're going after you and saying, I thought I was going to make $1.9 million because that's what your broker told me 2 years ago before I bought, you pull out a sales compliance form. It says, well, we asked you this at the time of the sale, if anyone had made a statement like that, and you said no. That's very helpful. Secondly, if in fact they really relied on it, our question about who did you speak to, we'd look and say, well, who are the names of this person's listed now? If he hasn't listed, this broker who he now says told him 2 years ago he read the tweet from this broker, then the issue becomes, how credible can it be if you haven't listed this person and you haven't talked about the money that he claimed you made that you're now saying 2 years later was the basis upon which you bought? So that's a good way a franchisor can protect themselves. So first of all, not going through a sale if they've discovered that there's been a real problem in the pre-sale process. And secondly, to use it at the end of the day, if subsequent to sale, there's some issue about what happened during the pre-sale process. Now when you go to the regulator activities, the fact that you had the best of intentions or you told him not to do it and he did it anyway is no defense to a claim that there's a violation, but it certainly would sort of mitigate the seriousness that which the regulator dealt with you if, in fact, they felt that you were really making every effort to make sure that your sales process was done right and people aren't making unauthorized statements about you. It certainly helps. Sometimes you'll convince them to just go away with a warning, and sometimes the regulator's adamant about it, you might wind up having to negotiate some kind of a consent order.
Sure. And with respect to closing checklists or compliance questionnaires, I mean, we know there are many franchisors that believe that they can sufficiently insulate themselves by abusing those checklists and questionnaires, and of course, that's a problem in itself. Does a franchisor have to be concerned about, let's say, incorrect, general, non-brand-specific franchise success statistics and general franchisee earning potential that brokers may state on their websites? I've seen it a lot in blogs and some within social media. And I'm talking about stuff that's, you know, non-brand specific and, you know, in general about what franchisees can earn.
Well, the definition of earnings claim is something that states or suggests a specific level or range of sales income or profits. So if a broker were to say, would specifically mention your franchise, that, people in this industry, people who buy this franchise, have $1.9 million in sales, there's no issue, but that they've stated or suggested a specific level of range. If they say people in the food service industry often make that kind of money, then it becomes a little more of a dicey question, because there are all kinds of people in the food service industry, there are all kinds of restaurants, there are all kinds of businesses. Would one reasonably believe that my specific franchise, my specific sandwich franchise, it's going to make $1.9 million because people in the food service industry average about $1.9 million. It's a sloppy thing to say. That's clear. But the issue would be one of credibility. Would somebody have read that statement and said, well, that makes me feel that I had now have a good idea what my sales would be? We would never recommend that a franchisor make that kind of a statement. But having made it, I'm not exactly sure, just standing alone, especially in view of what other information that a franchisor is going to be giving the franchisee during the sales process, whether it would be a credible, at the end of the day, a credible claim that that number stated is suggested to me a specific level or range of sales that I would make. And the reason I'd say that is the franchisor would say, well, here's my item 19. Now, if you notice, I've made an earnings claim where I show what our sales are, or I show what our revenues are, things like that. How could you believe a general statement that the people in the food industry make 1.9 when I have specifically told you what our system does? I think that would be a very telling argument. And you probably have picked up by now, I'm a very, very strong believer in making earnings claims, both from my regulatory experience and also in private practice. But in any event, that's one good way which an earnings claim will actually assist you. The second is, if you're not making an earnings claim, then as you know, there are two paragraph disclosures that you need to put in the item 19, both of which say, we don't make any claims and don't rely on anything we say. And if you've done that, and especially if you've then used some kind of a compliance certification where you've asked specific questions that would relate to any idea what you think, anyone give you any idea about sales, it would be hard for a franchisee to try to make a credible claim that this generic statement really had any influence whatsoever on them.
You know, but it's a lot of times brokers that are making the statements on their websites, not the franchisors,
right.
You know, and they put some of these general terms in there like, you know, 95% of franchisees succeed, or the U.S. Department of Commerce says that the average franchisee earns $150,000. And I know you've seen, I've seen a list. There's probably, you know, 10 or 15 different things that have come out of, you know, some type of, you know, government website, Department of Commerce website, something like that, and they'll say, you know, one out of every five, you know, businesses do this, or, you know, the gross for, you know, the average gross profits for franchisees in the United States is $150,000 a year. And it's all these very general terms that seem to get a franchise candidate, you know, it piques their interest about franchising. And of course, it's very easy for them to say, well, if I'm buying my franchise, then, of course, I've got an opportunity, a 95% chance of succeeding. And so I'm kind of referring to those general terms that I've seen a lot on different franchise broker sites.
Well, as I said before, I think that those are not good claims to make. And you're better off, even at the end of the day, when you're able to convince either a jury or the regulators that there's no reason I should be held liable for some generalized statement that a broker made. You're better off not getting into the issue where you have to defend that claim on the grounds that nobody could credibly believe that this was the case for our franchise for all the reasons, you know, that we've earlier said. You're better off not having to start up with it. Not a good practice. I don't know how you stop it. And one of the things you could do, I would suppose, is if you see that the franchisor, if your franchise broker or consultant that you've retained is using that in association with your business, like he might say, you know, food service thing, and we've got six people that we represent in the food service industry, and, you know, all of them are terrific. And, oh, by the way, the average is 1.9. I mean, this is somebody you should run away from. You don't want your name
sure.
on that list.
Right, absolutely, and I think that's very good advice. And whether you're using to franchisors, whether you're using a franchise broker or even a third party to do your, you know, advertising and your social media activity and write blogs for you, whatever the case might be, my advice would be to make sure you look over everything. Obviously, before you contract with them, see some of their work, see what they've done for other brands, make sure they understand franchising. And, of course, we know today that there's a lot of brokers just getting into it, bought a franchise to sell a franchise and have no clue what franchising is about. And certainly we could talk all day about training issues and responsibilities there. But, of course, you know, the franchisor, it's going to be aimed at you for responsibility and accountability. You need to be monitoring your brokers. You need to be monitoring your advertising or marketing people or any other consultants. Make sure they have an understanding of franchising. Make sure you don't see earnings claims. And then even after you contract with them, I highly suggest, you know, having a series of Google alerts and different things so that you might be able to see some of the activity that might be going on out there that is branded with your brand. And I think that's the way we need to look at it, because I like to use the word branded, because it's no different than taking that cattle and branding them on the side, because it's going to live on forever. And
I agree. One thing I would add, and it's not necessarily that the brokers are you know, evil or have bad intentions. The key oftentimes is you've got salespeople. That's what they do. And they don't really appreciate or understand the fact that there are very specific laws with respect to how you sell a franchise. It's not with the same laws you use when you sell a car, or you sell a boat, or you sell a house. And it's not necessarily the way that salespeople ordinarily function or think. And the bottom line is they're thinking, I'm not saying anything that's unreasonable. I'm not saying anything that's lying. Those are bona fide government statistics. And what's the big deal? And what they don't really understand is the big deal is the fact that you've got statutes that say you can't do it this way. And these statutes, to some extent, are sort of gotcha statutes, that it doesn't matter whether you had a bad intent or whether you deceived anybody. The answer is you can't do it. And a lot of the salespeople simply don't know the rules and really don't respect it. Or they think, nobody's seriously going to take this seriously. You know, there are no credible reason people would take this seriously. It's just sort of a swizzle. And it's just not true. And they come back to haunt you, and they don't really appreciate the risk.
Well, you know, definitely. We know the old wink, wink, nod, nod type of situation. And unfortunately, you know, and I'll say two statements here. You know, many franchisors mistakenly, you know, they take a see no, hear no, speak no evil approach when it comes to bad acts, whether it be by a third-party sales agent, broker, or sales organizations, because they think it's separate from the franchisor. But, you know, to your point, there are a lot of good franchise brokers out there, so please don't, you know, inundate my mailbox, my email box, with emails that I think franchise brokers are all bad. I think there's a lot of them out there that are good. I think there are a lot of them out of there that could be better with just a little bit of work. And I also think that using franchise brokers is probably an integral part of many franchise development strategies out there. John, to your point that, you know, earlier, that franchisors may choose to use a broker for a multitude of reasons, whether it be not wanting to dedicate their own resources to an in-house staff or whatever the case might be. So please, everybody, don't walk away from this thinking that, you know, I'm totally against brokers and John's totally against brokers. I know that's not the case. Use them widely, and make sure you watch what you're doing. And, you know, John, why do you think franchisors so often don't consult with their own attorney when they enter into a franchise broker or a franchise sales outsource organization agreement?
I think they don't appreciate the risk. I think they think it's pretty simple. He's going to go try to sell my franchises, and if he does, I'm going to pay him a commission. So what else is there? I'm going to give him the FDD, and I'm going to tell him, here's a copy of the franchise rule. This is all pretty simple. Just do it. And I think that they really don't appreciate the risk. They don't appreciate the concept of joint and several. Responsibility and liability. And, they think it's just a simple deal. I don't have to pay anybody unless they produce for me. So why should I worry?
Sure. And you brought up a good point, and you brought up a lot of good points, obviously, but a couple of minutes ago when you talked about, you know, enforcement and what have you. And I tend to believe that a lot of people out there that are getting away with things are doing so, and let's just put, you know, into the category of people that knowingly are doing things wrong and feel they're getting away with it, because they just believe that the enforcement actions, the enforcement isn't out there. I mean, you know, we don't hear a lot about it. We don't see many being made an example of. We have brokers that think, oh, well, you know, by the time this even comes to an enforcement issue, if it ever does, it'll be 5 or 6 years down the road and I'll be long gone. And we've talked on the show about, you know, personal liabilities, criminal liability, and a whole different things. And I know there's a lot of differences from one state to the other. But with respect to the FTC, you know, how likely is enforcement?
Unfortunately, the FTC has really had a very, very low enforcement profile over the last several years, and that's just the fact. And the states aren't really much better. I think that in some part, I think the industry is a very well-run industry, and I think that over the years, the disclosures that the laws that have come into place. I think that the franchise community has become much more vigilant to make sure they're doing it right. That's number one. Number two, you do have private rights of action in many under the state statutes and in some circumstances, even under the FTC rule, in a number of states with baby FTC laws that somehow will piggyback the FTC rule into effect. But I think one thing you need to keep in mind is you don't see a lot of these things because they never see the light of day. Because if you have a smart franchisee counsel and a smart franchisor counsel who recognizes a risk when they see it, when the franchisee counsel marches in the door for a meeting and says, oh, by the way, would you like to see some of the claims that were made prior to sale? They're not going to let that case go very far, and they're going to buy it out. For good reason. So, to some extent, if you have an educated franchisee legal bar and attorneys are doing their job, they're going to recognize a good case and they're going to be able to use it as leverage. And so, the case never does see the light of day. Also, I think you need to keep in mind. I'm a great believer in market forces, and that a lot of stuff is driven by market forces. Now, you have a franchisor who looks at a franchise prospect and is thinking over the term of the 10, 20-year term of the franchise agreement and said, you know, even if the guy's paying me his $50,000 fee tomorrow and joining us, he is not going to be successful, and I'm going to have more problems with him over the years. It's not worth it for the quick sale I make now to have to deal with this guy over the years. It's not going to work. I'm not going to start with him. So the market oftentimes will permit a franchise. The market that a franchise works in is one that is to some extent instituting its own checks to make sure they've got the right franchisee and everything was done right. The market that the franchise sales group functions on is completely different. Their market consists of finding somebody and bringing him to closure, and then getting my check for my commission, and then riding off into the sunset. My problem is over. And so, to some extent, they work from different constraints, and the market constraints that would somehow police some of these actions that a franchisor would impose are not the same constraints that appear for the sales group. And I think that's to some extent why the brokers are sometimes singled out as having, you know, more of a problem. I also think they're good brokers out there, and I think they do a good service. And for many franchisors who really don't want to gear up their own sales staff, the franchise brokers are first of all skilled, much more likely to be skilled salespeople than the franchisor staff. And secondly, they know their business, and they do a good service to identify and find prospects and help sell it. So they do. There are a lot of good ones, and the issue is just to be sure you're on top of them, and you get a good one, not a bad one, because the bad ones will give you a lot of trouble.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, going back to franchisors, you know, consulting with their attorneys when they're in an agreement or ready to reach an agreement with a franchise broker, you know, one of the things that I know is a necessity, you know, has to be some type of indemnification based on the what if. So if you would, if you'll tell me and our listening audience, you know, what is indemnification and why is that provision of the franchise broker agreement so vitally important to the franchisor?
Well, the indemnity provision basically says that if I get held responsible for something, you are going to indemnify me and pay me for whatever losses, if in fact the losses are based on your conduct. So if the FTC comes after me and I have to pay a $50,000 fine because of what you did, you owe me the $50,000. So from a theoretical standpoint, it's certainly an absolutely important provision to put in. But it's a practical standpoint, you got to keep in mind that the indemnity is only as good as the person who's backing it up. And if you, A, can't find the person anymore, or B, the person is doesn't have the funds to live up to the indemnity is not going to be worth the paper it's printed on. So I think you need to just not rest on the fact that, well, I've got an indemnity here that I don't, so I don't have to worry about it. I think you need to be a little more proactive. Make sure that there's a clear understanding of the franchise broker of what their authority is and what their authority isn't. That there's a what they can do, what they can't do. Also, to some extent, monitor them. I think you can monitor the same sites that they use and make sure that what they're saying, at least in print, is something that you're able to see on a continuous basis and be sure that they're doing it the right way. In terms of the scope of authority, again, just one other thing about it. If, in fact, you wind up in some kind of a regulatory action, it would be helpful if you said, well, this person went off and did this, but here's what I've told him. He's not permitted to do X, and he's not permitted to do Y. So if he did it, he was acting outside of the scope of his authority. I specifically prohibited him from doing that. It's certainly the kind of stuff that will put you in a better legal position to negotiate both with a regulator as well as in a private action in terms of the area of your responsibility for what the franchise broker did. But again, don't get hung up on the...
What's your recommendation, John, for a franchisor when they find out a broker, a third party, has made a non-compliant FPR, or what we used to call earnings claim, on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn, or on their website? I mean, you know, can the franchisor put the toothpaste back in the tube?
No, they can never put it back in the tube, but they can certainly fence in this damage. First of all, they should get rid of the broker right then and there. He's done. He's history. So we've dissociated themselves, so we don't have any future problems. In terms of the prior problems, again, we want to make sure it doesn't pass beyond the theoretical realm, and we can make sure that it doesn't come up in an actual franchise sale. So I would be especially cautious of any prospects that come in during the time where that Twitter post is really in circulation. And make sure that you understand why they're buying, why they're not buying. Did they see the Twitter? Did they not? Do they understand it's wrong? Or make sure that there's something in print that is discrediting whatever the Twitter post is. Compliance certification, again, is a good way of doing that. So that no question at the end of the day that even if that was out there, it had absolutely nothing to do with the prospect's decision to buy to buy the franchise. And if you find that it really is, that it really was an important ingredient, then it sounds hard to mention, but you gotta really paper that up and make sure that they know better. What we do sometimes do when a compliance certification, when someone answers the compliance certification wrong and says, oh, yeah, I did this, or I did get that, is A, go on record as saying that was wrong. Nobody was authorized to speak to you about that. That was absolutely wrong. The information was not accurate. And then what we sometimes do, depending on the nature of the violation, we'd say, and, you know, we need to have a cooling off period here. We're going to discontinue everything for a period of 30, 60, 90 days or something like that. Then think about it. We've already told you it's wrong. Spend some time, thinking about it. Look elsewhere. And then, 30, 60 days from now, if you're still more interested, then we can start talking again. So at least the record is clear that this was not a factor whatsoever in anyone's decision to buy.
Sure. And I think it's safe to say that franchisors certainly can use you know, franchise brokers as part of their, you know, recruitment strategy and development efforts. But, you know, it's definitely not a risk-free proposition or a plug-and-play type of scenario. In fact, the use of franchise brokers, since they are third parties, you know, probably requires even greater vigilance by the franchisor than of their own staff. But certainly use franchise brokers as you see fit and as part of your strategy, and make sure you do your necessary, you know, review, ongoing review. Everything is in line with laws and statutes and everything else. And John, we are running low on time, and I would like to thank you for being my guest today, and would love to invite you back again. Maybe we could even get you back with Leslie again on the show together, because I really would look forward to doing that.
Well, I enjoyed it, and I hope that I was helpful to you and your listeners.
Well, we appreciate it. I'm sure you will. Remember, today's show and all segments of Franchise Today are available on demand at blogtalkradio.com/franchisetodayshow. We also remind you to visit the Franchise Today Facebook page, and please like us there. Next week, my guest is Adam Siegelheim of Stark & Stark, as he brings us up to date on the then-completed IFA Legal Symposium. And joining us on the show next will be co-producer Joe Caruso. I also look forward to getting Joe to share some of his thoughts behind this year's Franchise Legal Series. And in case you don't know, I mean, Joe does a great effort in researching and writing Franchise Today's outline to ensure our shows are informative and compelling. So, until next week, my name is Paul Segreto, wishing you the best, the very best, in this great franchise. Today is out.